that lovely version of Mao's Tsur Rock of Ages reminds us that in Hanukkah, as in so much else in Jewish life, the familiar isn't always the old or the oldest. It's a very old Italian melody for Mao's Tsur, which was familiar during the Renaissance and later in the synagogues of central and northern Italy. Let's start Hanukkah with a quiz. True or false? On Hanukkah, we read a Megillah. How many say false? How many say true? Now, obviously, we read the Megillah on Purim. The wonderful story of the beautiful Esther and the wicked Haman and the shrewd but capable Mordecai. But there was a custom which was practiced in most of the communities of our people for well over 12 or 1300 years to read a Megillah on Hanukkah. Now, the word Megillah simply means a scroll, small scroll. And in the days when people still wrote books by hand, in the Middle East particularly, most small books were written in scroll form. And so, actually, in the Bible, we have five Megillot, five scrolls. Ruth, Song of Songs, Ecclesiastes, and Lamentations, as well as Esther. But the Megillah which I am referring to is called the Megillat Antiochus, the Megillah of Antiochus. It was written probably in the third or fourth century of this era, originally in Aramaic, quickly translated into Hebrew. And it is a scroll which, as the scroll of Esther, was read in the synagogue in order to provide historical background for the holiday, so everybody would know the events of the day. Now, I read to you earlier the history of Hanukkah, as is told in the earliest source, the Book of Maccabees, which is written within 80 or 100 years of the event. But this is the story of Hanukkah as it was read in the synagogue from about the 3rd or 4th century down to the deep Middle Ages. And notice how different the story is. Long ago, there ruled in Syria a great emperor by the name of Antiochus. His capital was named after him, Antiochia. It was by the sea. It's a great, great, powerful, and rich city. And Antiochus was a megalomaniac, a great conqueror. In 23 years of his reign, he'd managed to conquer almost all of the known world. Only the Jews had tended to be restive and unhappy under his rule. And he came to feel that it was only if he could destroy the will of the Jews that he would be able to conquer the world. And so he summoned to his palace at Antiochia a great general by the name of Nicanor. And he equipped Nicanor with a powerful army, and he sent Nicanor to Jerusalem with orders to create unrest, to prohibit the observance of the Jewish tradition, to incite riots in the city so he'd have an excuse to put down the population and to kill many of them, and ultimately to undo the sense of pride and dignity which allowed the Jewish people to survive. And Nicanor went to Jerusalem, and he carried out his mandate, and he precipitated riots in the city, and he put them down with bloodshed. And he set up an idol to Zeus in the temple of Jerusalem, and he created great confusion and anger, and he slew many of the teachers of our people. And finally, the son of one of the important priests of Jerusalem, a young man by the name of Jonathan, requested an audience of Nicanor. And Nicanor granted him that audience. And Jonathan brought into the palace a sword under his cloak, and when he came before the king, before the general, he slew Nicanor. And the Greeks, temporarily without leadership, fell into confusion, and Jews who were hidden here and there in the city rose up, and they slew the leaders of the Greeks, and the rest of the Greek soldiers fled. But Antiochus was not to be put off, and he summoned yet a more powerful general by the name of Bargius, and he gave him yet a more powerful army, and he dispatched Bargius and this army to Jerusalem with orders to suppress the Judean rebellion. And Bargus proceeded to try to carry out his orders, and he and the forces of Jonathan, notice Jonathan, not Judah, who is the senior brother and the most important hero, he and Jonathan fight a series of battles, and ultimately Jonathan is killed. And then Judah appears for the first time. And this brother proclaims a great fast, and he proclaims that the day of prayer for national deliverance. And then he leads out the army again into battle, the Jews into battle, and this time they are able to defeat Bargus and his hosts. But again, Antiochus re-equips the army of his people. And this time, when the battle is met, Judah falls in battle. And their father, Mattathias, appears on the scene. And Mattathias leads the Judeans to their great victory. And then Mattathias comes to the temple, which has been polluted, and it is he, not Judah the Maccabee, who cleanses the temple. And when they search for oil, they find the famous cruse of oil, which is, as you remember, had only enough oil in it to last for one day, but lasts for the 8 days of the Feast of Dedication. And that vial, according to the Megillat Antiochus, is actually sealed with the seal of the first high priest who served in the Temple of Solomon nearly 800 years before. And there the scroll of Antiochus ends with a great praise to God for deliverance of the people. Now this is the story of Hanukkah as it was known to most Jews down into the Middle Ages. How does it happen that the story had become so different than the story with which we are familiar? There lies an interesting tale, one of the tales that's new about Hanukkah. The book of Maccabees was written sometime in the second century, or early first century before the Common Era. And there are any number of historians at the time who, in one way or another, refer to this event. And then at the end of the first century of the Common Era, the well-known historian Josephus draws together all of these stories, and he presents in The Wars of the Jews a rationalistic explanation of the battles between the high priest seeking preference, which led to the interference of the Syrians in the activities of Jerusalem, the frustration of Antiochus, who had wanted to conquer Egypt but had been prevented by the new power, Rome, from doing so, the attempt to impose a loyalty oath on the Judeans by having them worship the patron god of Antiochus, Zeus Olympios, and all the events which happened subsequently. Now, this history was well known during the first 200-300 years after the events, but it was not known to most of our ancestors after that time. Why not? Well, we begin to unravel the story when we look at the Talmud. The Talmud is a great compendium of law and of tradition and of observation. The Babylonian Talmud in its modern English translation runs to about 40 volumes, so it contains a great deal of material. And one would expect to find reference in this material to Hanukkah, to this holiday which is part of the annual cycle of life of our people. Almost everything else in the life of our people is there. But there's no tractate in the Talmud called Hanukkah. Indeed, if you look through this entire compendious literature, which was drawn together around the 5th or 6th century, but represents material from many centuries before, you find only one very brief paragraph, about an inch of type, which has to do with Hanukkah. It comes in the middle of the tractate about Sabbath. And the question it begins with is, my Hanukkah, what is Hanukkah? As if these great sages didn't have the faintest idea what the historical background of the holiday was. And they answer it this way. What is Hanukkah? Hanukkah falls on the 25th of Kislev. It's a time in which there's not to be fasting and there's not to be lamentations. It commemorates when the Syrian Greeks entered the temple, they despoiled it. When the Hasmoneans entered the temple, they purified it. They found there a cruse of oil, enough for only one day. Nes Gadol Hayasham, a great miracle took place then. God caused the oil to be enough for 8 days. Therefore, we celebrate the Hanukkah, and we are to recite on Hanukkah the Hallel Psalms, the great Hallelujah Psalms, which praise God. And that's all that the Talmud tells us about Hanukkah. Now, why? Were they ashamed of the history? there something unseemly or demeaning about Jews or Judaism in the history behind Hanukkah? Not at all. It's a story of daring do and of courage and of conviction. Matthias and his sons were fighting for the integrity of the faith against a tyrant who was determined to set up an altar to an idol in the great temple, against a tyrant who was determined to extirpate ultimately the unique teachings of the Jewish tradition from off the face of the earth. Why then did the rabbis of rabbinic times, the first, second, third, fourth century of our era, object to the retelling of Hanukkah, the story of Hanukkah? And the answer lies in the events of their day. When you go to visit Israel, you're taken to Matsada, and you see there the great fortress in which the zealots held out for nearly 3 years against the army of Rome. The history of Matsada is presented to you as a great triumph of Jewish courage, and persistence, and commitment. But in the longer scheme of things, if one takes an historical or philosophic view of the events, the two great revolts against Rome, the revolt that began in 66 before of the Common Era and lasted till 70, that ended with the destruction of the temple, the revolt of Bar Kokhba, which began 80 years later in 132 before the Common Era and lasted to 135, these were two of the greatest tragedies ever to occur to the Jewish people, bar none. They reduced Judaism to what it has been ever since, a minority faith whose people were few, whose impact was always through its impact on others rather than simply in its life on its own. Before these two great revolts, it's estimated that the Jews of the Roman Middle East, the Jews of the Eastern Roman Empire, from Turkey through the Middle East through to Egypt, represented nearly 20% of the population of that part of the world. One in five was a Jew. After these revolts, over 1 million were killed during the first revolt, 1.5 million were killed during the second revolt, and there was a revolt in some of the provinces in Cyrenaica and in Syria in 112, 115, where 500,000 Judeans seem to have been killed. Many more were crucified by the Romans as traitors. Many were thrown into the arena to fight the gladiator fights. Many were simply forced into exile and were taken to the far corners of the empire. Jewish life was reduced to a fight for mean existence. And those who led the reconstruction of Jewish life after these two great revolts, those we know as the Pharisees, the rabbis, the creators of the Talmud of rabbinic Judaism, were determined to root out as best they could that urge to rebel, that love of the sword, that conviction that if there's a will, there's a way, which had led those who were called zealots, another word might be fanatics, those who were liberation fighters, to force the community emotionally, psychologically, to take up arms in a battle that they could not have expected to win. In origin, Hanukkah is the 4th of July. It's the great holiday of the Hasmoneans, which celebrated independence, the victory of the troops against other troops. And it was surely on Hanukkah that those who came together during Roman times to complain about Roman misrule and overtaxation, the iron-booted administration of Rome, that they came together and met and sang great martial songs and convinced themselves that now was the time to reach out and to fight and to struggle and ultimately to win. So Hanukkah became a danger, a psychological and emotional danger to those who recognized that certainly now, after these two tragic defeats, to continue this war, this martial spirit, to encourage it, was to invite further disaster. And so they kept Hanukkah, but they blotted out, literally, they blotted out the memory of the events which were behind it. And how did they do so? They did so by abandoning, by, in a sense, censoring by silence, by inattention, the book of the Maccabees, the books of Josephus. All these were completely set aside. They disappeared from the shelves, from the curriculum, from study. And they did so by transforming Hanukkah from the 4th of July into the Festival of Lights. The cruise of oil suddenly appears. There's nothing about this remarkable cruise of oil in the Book of the Maccabees. There's nothing about this remarkable cruise of oil in Josephus. It appears for the first time in the Talmud. It's part of a propaganda campaign, a miracle devised as the set piece of an advertising campaign to convince Jews that this holiday was not what it was, and it ought to be seen as something entirely different. Now, how is it that we recaptured the history of Hanukkah? Well, it's interesting. We owe the fact that the traditional synagogue for many centuries now has known and talked of the real history, because we could come back to it once the danger was over, to a man who is forever anonymous to us. Not a great scholar, not one of the great rabbis of Israel, but a man who apparently was something of a reader. We think he may have lived in southern Italy, we're not sure. We think he may have lived around the 7th or 8th century, we're not sure about that either. We're sure he lived before the 9th century, because he's quoted already in the 9th century. A man who had apparently had a schooling which was more than rabbinic, because he could read Latin. A man who had, for some reason or other, access to the texts of that were sacred to the church. And a man who somehow, this Jew, read in the library of a church or a monastery a Latin version of Josephus. Josephus had written his history in Greek. And he found also in that monastery, or wherever, the library, wherever it may have been, a Latin translation of the Book of Maccabees. The church, interestingly, had preserved a great number of the texts of biblical times which Jews had set aside. Set aside because the Pharisees were determined to shape Judaism very specifically and to keep away anything which might raise up certain questions to their point of view. He found there the Apocrypha, and in the text of the Apocrypha, he found the Book of Maccabees. And this unknown man, who is known as Josephon, little Josephus, prepared in Hebrew a paraphrase of the Wars of the Jews, in which he transformed Josephus from what he had in fact been, the Jewish Benedict Arnold, the man who had been in command of the Judean forces in the Galilee in the early part of the First Revolt, who had seen the handwriting on the wall and had proven to be a traitor and had sold himself to Vespasian, the great Roman general, on the grounds that he was both a turncoat and a prophet. He came before Vespasian. He prophesied that Vespasian would become the great emperor of Rome. And when, in fact, this turned out to be so, Vespasian thought of this man as a holy man, and he brought him to Rome, and he set him up in a palace in Rome where he wrote his great histories. Josephon read these histories, paraphrased them into Hebrew, and his text became one of the most popular texts in the Middle Ages. It was the way in which Sadia Gaon and Rashi and Judah Halevi and Abraham Ibn Ezra rediscovered the history of Jewish life in the second and first centuries before the Common Era, the history which is not included in the Bible. He's quoted again and again and again. And his text is really one of the most important texts that we have. So in about the 11th or 12th century, the Jews kept the reading of Megillat Antiochus as part of the synagogue worship. Why not? It was a custom. They liked it. In it, Antiochus was evil. Antiochus got his just desserts. His generals were defeated. He was so disturbed by the defeat that on the very day that the temple was rededicated, he jumped off the walls of Antiochia into the sea and drowned himself. It was a proof of the power of God over the forces of evil. They kept reading the Megillat Antiochus. You'll find it in the traditional machzorim, the traditional liturgies. But at the same time, they knew now of the history such as we tell it to our children. And they began to reshape the history in ways which brought again the possibility of Jewish activity, Jewish action, self-defense to the fore. Now, I present you this history of Josephon and of Megillat Antiochus, and the first book of Maccabees, because it raises up the enigma which for all of us lies behind this holiday, which in our day has become a children's holiday, but really is not. To what degree ought human beings to be impatient about achieving their goals for human society and human life? How much can we achieve by direct action, by simply pulling our way ahead? And how patient should we be? How trusting that somehow God in his time will see to it that redemption will take place? And obviously we can't come down on the one side or on the other. Those who insist there is no time but now, court defeat. Some things can be achieved. Some goals cannot be achieved. Those who fold their hands in prayer and wait patiently for the divine miracle will achieve little. Some things will happen inevitably, and they'll call them, they say they happen because of God, and some awful things will happen inevitably, and they will ascribe those to God's punishment. In modern Jewish life, ever since the 1940s, certainly, we have tilted ourselves heavily on the side of direct action. We're going to take our fate into our hands and handle it. We're going to create the state of Israel. We're going to strengthen the state. We're going to prevent anybody ever again from doing to us what Haman, or Hitler, or Antiochus set out to do. And obviously in those moments of extremis, those who fight are doing all that should be done and can be done, even if the fight is suicidal. But what of times where the situation is not quite so black and white? Where are the times when it's not clear whether, in fact, we can throw out all the evil men and replace them with all good men and women? Can we, in fact, force history to turn around and become exactly what we want it to become? Are there times when the rabbinic council, Shev al Taaseh, sit and do nothing, is more valuable than Chazak Ematz, be strong, be active, be of good courage? Obviously, there are times for action and there are times for inaction. And I don't intend this morning to try and lay out when those times should be and should not be. But clearly, the spirit of Hanukkah refracts all of that paradoxical problem of philosophy, which is at the heart of our faith. Moses tells Joshua, Chazak ve'ematz, be strong and of good courage, and lead the people. The rabbi said, think of the cruse of oil. Have some patience. And this balance between action and patience, between frustration and insistence, is one that each of us, within the context of our private lives and within the context of our national lives and our Jewish lives, must somehow weigh and work out. If you can't weigh it and work it out, at least remember it's a problem. Amen.